Happy to have all those people who are too lazy to go to somebody else's class after Rubel. Thank you for staying. I appreciate that. My name is Joe Beam. We're going to be talking about something today. Actually, today and tomorrow, if you choose to come back, I'm going to show you some things about how to rescue people who are in trouble. The difficulty is that as I show you this, it's really very simple, but it's also kind of tedious. What I mean by that is the system we're going to show you absolutely works. It's been proven since the 1960s. It's a workable and doable system. The downside to it is it does take some effort. Now, it only takes a few hours, but it means a few hours of doing it right. And therefore, I have shared it with many church leaders around America, and very few of them wind up actually doing it because it does take some effort. So I'm just warning you in advance that what you're going to see is very, very good, but it's also very detailed. And if you ever decide to use it, if you don't do it just this way, it probably won't work. And that's not because of the fact that I figured it out. Actually, I learned from other people who have done it for a long time. But it really, really is very good. Now, as we go through the PowerPoints are rather detailed. And you might be thinking, wow, how can I write all that stuff down? Well, don't worry about writing it all down. We're actually putting it into an ebook. And you can have the ebook for free. How about that? Just, you know, a $2,000 donation to my nonprofit. You can have... You can have the ebook for free. As a matter of fact, Marriage Helper is the name of our nonprofit, Marriage Helper. If you go to www.marriagehelper.com, okay, just think Marriage Help ER, Marriage Help ER, marriagehelper.com. Right now, you can join for free. And if you join, then you have access to all kinds of ebooks, and there'll be different videos and all kinds of things that you can have for free by being a member. Now, there are some things on our website that, you know, we do charge money for. But the kind of things like this, we're actually going to take these two audios and put it with that ebook, and you can get it for yourself or for your church leaders or for other people trying to help folks. So you don't have to worry about writing all this thing down. You'll get it in the ebook if you choose it, okay? And you can have the audios as well. Now, I realize I just caused a problem for the people downstairs selling the audio, because you'll say, well, we can get them for free off of Beam site. Yeah, you can. MarriageHelper.com, you can, okay? Now, I'll go through this and hopefully make it make some sense. Now, in our nonprofit world, we work with marriages, and specifically, we work a great deal with marriages in crisis. For example, I just did one last weekend in Dallas, okay? We do intensive three-day workshops. I mean, we start Friday morning at 8 a.m. That's when we start with the couples. We're there before that. We wind up at 6:30 p.m. on Friday, so 8 a.m. to 6:30 p.m., they're actually with us. Saturday, we replicate that, 8 a.m. to 6:30 p.m. Sunday, we go from noon to 6:30 p.m. because we do them in churches. If we did them other places, we'd have to charge couples a whole lot more, so we do them in churches. By the way, if you happen to be a church that's got good facilities to use and you're close to a major airport, we'd love to talk to you about coming into it in your church building sometimes so we can reach more people. This past weekend, and we would never reveal identities, you understand that, but I'll give you a quick example. A young lady, she was 28 years old. She's married. She and her husband had a rough time of it, and I may or may not tell you how rough it was, but she is now in love with another guy. He's 36 years old. He is married, but he's from another country. His wife and children live in the other country, but she tells me he's never really been happy in his marriage. Anybody shocked to hear that, by the way? And so because she was having a rough time with her husband, she falls in love with the other guy. They're in a full-fledged, intense affair. The husband finds out about our workshop and tries to get her to come, and the only way he can convince her is that he offers her a better deal than a divorce. He said, as a matter of fact, when we sell the house, we're going to have this much cash left. You can have half of that without any kind of having to get an attorney or anything else if you just agree to go to the three-day workshop. We have a lot of couples that come like that, by the way, because they're offered some kind of a deal like that. But on Friday morning, what she says to me is, I'm in love with the other guy. Please don't be offended if I sit over here and don't pay much attention. I'm just here for the money. He's going to give me the money, and that's why I'm here. And so we go through our intense three-day workshop. At the end of the workshop, she tells the entire group, I'm still in love with the other guy, but I'm going to write him a letter and break it off. I'm going to save my marriage. Now, we see that a lot, a whole lot. So you must understand that in our workshops, we see what I would refer to as miracles, in the sense that people have made up their mind they're going to do one thing, and 3 days later, they change their mind to do something else. You say, wow, and then why would you be teaching us how to do interventions? Because whether you send them to our workshop or you send them to a counselor or you just help them some other way, people are not going to be helped if somebody doesn't do an intervention. What I mean is once they get on the path, once they start going a direction, somebody has to help turn that path, and it certainly can't be us. So every day, at least it seems like every day, well, they told me this clicker would work. Would somebody just be kind enough to reach back there and just push a button? Any button, I don't care, any button. See if we can make this thing advance. Okay, one more if you don't mind. No. That's what we say every day. Because people will call. A guy will call and say, my wife's in love with somebody else. Would you please call her and talk to her? No. My husband's leaving me. He says he's tired of me, don't want to be around me anymore. Would you call him and talk to him? No. My parents are fighting. They're just going at each other like dogs, and I don't know how to help them. Will you please call my parents? No. Now you might be thinking, wait a minute, why you guys exist if you tell everybody no? We go on to explain, if I call somebody who doesn't know me and I have no relationship with, how do you think that's going to help? Because the person's going to say, who are you? Why are you sticking your nose in my life? Get off my phone, and they'll hang up. I have seen it again and again and again and again. Now, I have tried it. I have tried it in the past before we finally started saying no. A lady, for example, called and told me that her husband was into some stuff. This was several years ago. I was speaking at Pepperdine. As a matter of fact, her husband was also speaking at Pepperdine, so you can understand then that he was some position of ministry in the Churches of Christ, right? She said that she had discovered that he was actually involved in some homosexual activity, and that she really, really wanted me to approach her husband at Pepperdine. And I said, I will do it only if you tell him I'm coming. I mean, I don't want to walk in out of the clear blue. She said, well, she's heard of you. He's heard of you. He knows who you are. And I said, tell him, none of that stuff's true. So she told him I was coming, and I actually walked into his class. I'll never forget it. I walked into his class and sat down on the front row, and that's when he started to perspire. By the time he finished the class, the man was soaking wet. His shirt was soaking wet. And because he kept looking at me, and I know what he was thinking, is this guy's going to confront me about the bad stuff I'm doing. And as soon as they had the end of the class, I approached him and said, we really need to talk. He said, I'd love to, but I have an appointment, and literally ran out of the room, was gone. It just doesn't work for somebody who doesn't know somebody to try to confront them. Do you? It just does not work. So, no. It's not that we don't want to help. It's that we're not the right people to help. If you mind that next slide. Okay, then who is it that's going to help? Who is it that can actually do that? This is my friend Buddy Bell. And this is Buddy Bell's phone. I did it to Ruble just an hour ago. Only he didn't embarrass me. He's a nicer guy than I am by far. Yeah. Hey, that's one of my dearest friends on planet Earth. I love that man with all of my heart. Buddy Bell is awesome. Okay, who should be doing the help then? Well, spiritual leaders of the church. Now, I may sound a little cynical here, so please forgive me. The fact that a person has a church office does not make him a spiritual leader. Because there are some elders who are not spiritual men. There are some deacons, Bible class teachers, ministers, etc., who just aren't spiritual men. That's why I didn't put ministers and elders and deacons up there. Spiritual leaders of the church. Friends that the person respects. Somebody in the family who is willing to help. Or even on occasion, it would be co-workers that would do this. Next slide, sir. Thank you. Okay. Why don't people do it? Well, they fear they don't have enough evidence, or they fear they don't have enough skill or training, or enough understanding of the situation. And so when I tell somebody, no, we can't do that. We don't know your husband. We don't know your wife. We can't do that. Inevitably, the next thing we will say, whether it's me talking to them or somebody else on our staff, is, will somebody from your church do it? And often they will say, we have gone to our church elders or our church leaders, and they said that they really don't know what to do about this, and so they have done nothing. Or one or two of them went to see him or her. They had a short conversation. They prayed with them and said, if we can help you, let us know. And that was it. They've made no other. Right here in Nashville once, I was having lunch with an elder from one church, sitting with a man from another church. We were sitting there, and he said, my wife's leaving me, and I've asked the elders of my church if they will help me. Now, I'm not trying to beat up elders. I'm just saying this is the kind of thing we see repeatedly. He said they really don't do things like this, and I should seek help someplace else. On occasion, then, I have asked, may I speak to your church leaders? For example, the guy out at Pepperdine who sweated and ran. I finally talked to his wife again, and I said, would you ask those church leaders if I can talk to them? And one of them finally called me. By that time, by the way, they had actually found out what the guy was doing, and they had terminated him. And so I said on the phone to the guy, well, I'm glad you took some action. What did you say? What did he say when you confronted him about his sin? He said, well, we didn't. I said, what do you mean you didn't? Well, we just terminated him. Our attorney said if we told him that we were firing him because he was homosexual, actively homosexual, we could be sued. And therefore, we just told him that he didn't keep office hours like he should, and he's terminated, and he's gone. I said, what about the man's soul? Wouldn't that be more important than a lawsuit? To which he said, this is not your church. This is none of your business. And he hung up. And I thought, right. And I know who else's church it ain't. So what you have to do is to find people who care enough, because not knowing what to do, people tend to do little or nothing at all. And it doesn't necessarily mean they're bad people. Often they're just people who are functioning in fear. Since I don't know what to do, I don't know how to do. Now, some of you may know my story. My wife, Alice, is sitting halfway back there. Alice and I have been married to each other twice. If you haven't heard that, let me just briefly tell you. We were married to each other for 15 years the first time. We've been married to each other 27 years this time, okay? Which makes it extremely difficult to tell people how long you've been married. How long you've been married? 27 years. How old's your daughter? 43. So I thought, wait a minute, 15 years the first time, 27, that's 42 years. How long have you been married? 42 years. How old's your daughter? 43. So now I just say we've been married 45 years, give or take three. I left Alice. I divorced Alice in 1984. I was the bad guy. I was wrapped up in sin, my own sin. I didn't care what was right anymore. And so many of the things I'm going to teach you out of this, not only have we learned from really good people who know what they're doing, I can tell you from the other side how it feels for the person who's involved in it. So I have been there. Now, nobody tried to do an intervention on me. Well, one did later. Rubel Shelley did try to do an intervention later, and I'll tell you about that as we go along. But at the time, nobody did. But interestingly, not only did people not try to rescue me, when I abandoned Alice, when I divorced her, I left her, actually people ignored her too. And I'm quite convinced it's because they didn't know what to do. They didn't know what to say to her. They didn't know how to help her. And so she wound up just as abandoned at the very time when she needed as much help as she could possibly get. Now, I'm not saying that those were bad people. I'm really not. I'm not trying to say anybody's bad people. I'm saying that typically, though, if people don't know what to do, they don't do anything. So the next slide, please, sir. All right. Sometimes you hear these, and both of these, by the way, are totally wrong. Totally wrong. You can't help someone until he reaches rock bottom. That is a lie that's been bought by so many people because so many people say it, that you can't help somebody until they reach rock bottom. Let me just say it this way. I'll explain it more later. You can let people hit their own bottom, or you can create a bottom for them that won't be as bad as the one they'll create for themselves. So sometimes you need to create a bottom for them that's not nearly as bad as where they're headed. The second is this. You know you can't help someone who doesn't want help. I hear that all the time. Actually, one of the times I was on the Today Show, it was really cool. Anybody ever watched the Today Show? The first time I was on there, I made Lester Holt sweat. I was speaking to Dave Ramsey. Anybody know who Dave Ramsey is? I was speaking at Dave's place the other day, and I love the way Dave introduces me. He said, you know, we love Joe, but he makes us nervous because we never know what he's going to say next. I thought, you're catching on, Dave. You're catching on. The second time I was on the Today Show, I was interviewed by Natalie Morales. Anybody know who she is? On television, she's an attractive woman. In person, she's stunning. I mean, she's just absolutely gorgeous. I think what makes her even prettier is that I don't think she has a clue that she's pretty. When it was down-to-earth people you ever met. But I'll tell you how pretty she is. I've spoken to millions of people around the world. She said, I'm Natalie, and I went, This psychologist finds out she can be on with us, and so she runs out and jumps in between Natalie and me. So there's Natalie, and there she is, and here I am. So this woman could be in every camera shot. That's fine. That's fine. Interestingly, in the green room, I asked her where she got her doctorate, and she couldn't remember the name of the school. She said, I know it was in California. Anyway, here she is. And I'm talking to Natalie, and she keeps piping in, and she says, you can't help anybody that doesn't want help. And you can't save a marriage unless both people want to save it. And I said, au contraire. I don't even know what that means, but that's what I said. I said, we have proven that if we can put a couple in a room with us for 3 days, neither one of them has to want to save the marriage. We still have a 3 out of 4 success rate, 3 out of 4 still married 7 years later. She looked at me and she said, well, then you're better than I am. And I thought, okay, it's national television. Be calm. Don't say what you're thinking. These things are wrong. Hit the next slide, please. Now, a lot of what I'm going to give you comes out of this book by Vernon Johnson. Vernon Johnson, back in the 1960s, was the guy who said, you know, we don't have to wait for alcoholics and drug addicts to hit their own bottom. We can rescue people. Now, it was against the prevailing wisdom of the day, which was people have to hit rock bottom and they have to want to be helped. And so many people at the time said, what are you thinking? This will not work. That book worked. Now, that book is totally about alcoholism, okay? We've modified it a little bit to talk about things like adultery and other things like that. But if you want the book, and again, this will be in the e-book, so you can look it up if you want. It's Intervention, How to Help Someone Who Doesn't Want Help by Vernon Johnson, Doctor of Divinity, Johnson Institute, Minneapolis, and this is 1986. He first started it in the 1960s. This book came out in the 1986. The next slide, please, sir. Okay, he realized that the person continues a destructive behavior because they live in a state of self-delusion. He reasoned that if a focused group of people could break through the rationalizations, they could bring him to a point of lucidity where he'd recognize a need for help. Next slide, please. Unless a person is completely corrupt, he must delude himself into believing the damaging behavior either is not damaging or is much less damaging than it actually is. So if you ever talk to somebody doing something just totally destructive to their lives or the lives of others, and when you try to talk about how bad it is, they tell you it's not bad at all. As a matter of fact, sometimes they tell you it's actually good. Or have you ever had this? Like they're married to one, they fall in love with another, and they say, God sent me the lover? Anybody ever had that case? You know how hard it is to convict people of sin when they partner God on the sin? It becomes very difficult. So the next thing then is this. There are two major points about self-delusion. If you're going to help people, you need to understand. The first is this. The self-deluded person cannot rescue herself from the addictive behavior. Now, by the way, I said addictive behavior, and just a minute ago I mentioned infidelity. You might be thinking, do you think infidelity is addictive? My answer is yes. Now, I am an addict, okay? I'm a recovering alcoholic. Right. When Alice and I were apart those 3 years, I did a lot of drinking and a lot of drugging. Now, I didn't take many illegal drugs. I just waited for somebody to invite me to dinner. I discovered pretty quickly they kept their narcotics and their Valium and stuff either in a bathroom cabinet or a kitchen cabinet, and that's what I stole. And for some reason, people would not have me back. Small-minded people. And I drank a lot of that stuff, and I took a lot of that stuff. I'll let you know what an alcoholic is like one night in Atlanta in a strip club. You understand, I had left everything holy to me at that point. I drank 6 beers and took 20 Valium. Rubel was in here a minute ago. When I first told Rubel and his wife Myra about that, Myra has a sense of humor that's amazing. She said, there must have been some ugly strippers. So, actually, I don't remember a whole lot about it. The next time I woke up, I was in Oxford, Alabama, and I was driving across the sidewalk at a McDonald's, and people were running from me. The next time I woke up, I was in Birmingham, Alabama, in front of my attorney's office. I had a key to his office because a few years earlier, I'd led that man to Jesus. Nobody was there. It was just breaking daylight. I opened the office. I got as far as the receptionist area before I passed out, and that's where I was when he came in. He was the first one in. He just thought I was drunk. He could smell the alcohol. If he realized what drugs I'd had in me, he would have taken me to the hospital. He just thought I was drunk, so he took me home. He put me to bed, and I slept 48 hours. Then he came in and he said, it's Sunday morning. We're going to church. I said, I don't go to church. He was a big guy. And we went to church. When finally I was sober enough, the first thing I did was walk around the car looking for blood, trying to figure out if I'd killed somebody. So I understand addiction. You understand when I say understand addiction? Anybody else doubt I'm an addict based on what I just said? Now, I don't do that anymore. Now I eat. I mean, and eat. Somebody looked at one of my books the other day at the picture on the bank and said, what happened to that guy? I ate him. But at least I'll never say to a policeman, if I just hadn't had that third donut. The self-deluded person cannot. And you say, okay, but you're saying people in infidelity wind up being addicts? Absolutely. It's just as much of a high. It does just as much for you as the drugs do. Let me explain addiction to you very simply. Go to AA sometime. You'll see 4,000 cigarette butts outside. That's from the guy that got there early. You go inside, you're going to see gallons and gallons of coffee because we still drink a lot of stuff. Okay? And if you talk to anybody who's been going to AA for any length of time, if you ask them, why do you drink? They're going to say this. I like the way it makes me feel. You're thinking, oh, that means high. That's a part of it. What it really means is I'm not hurting when I'm drinking. It's the same thing that drives people to the internet pornography. They surveyed a bunch of guys that do that all the time. They said, what's the primary emotion you feel when you're looking at the porn on the internet? And they said, peace. If you understand addiction, it makes all the sense in the world. When I'm doing that, I'm not in the real world. When I'm doing that, I don't have any pain. I can eat and not think and feel while I'm eating, whatever the addiction is. And I'll guarantee you that an affair partner becomes addictive as well. You follow? And the addicted person cannot rescue themselves. The self-deluded person is usually very adept at keeping people from effectively dealing with her behavior by adroitly diverting them to dealing with her delusions. In other words, you try to deal with their behavior, they shuffle you over to deal with their delusions instead. Now, let me see if I can explain more about that. Please, sir. Okay, there are these phases of delusion. Now, I don't think I'm going to get into the 6 steps today of how to actually do the intervention, but if I can get you to understand the 4 phases of delusion, this is essential, it's crucial to, if you ever choose. The first is rationalization. Next slide. Thank you, sir. Rationalization is an unconscious process that keeps a person from feeling bad about his actions. Of necessity, the person does not recognize the rationalizations because recognizing that he's rationalizing means that he cannot rationalize any longer. So when they tell you a rationalization and you say, you're lying, they're going, I'm telling you the absolute truth. And from their mind, they are telling you the absolute truth. You must understand they cannot see it as a rationalization. Because as soon as they do, it doesn't work. Are you with me so far? As soon as you do. And so if you had met me in 1984, when I'd been fired by my church, I was a minister up until then, and I had left Alice and all those kinds of things, if you start talking to me about my behavior, what do you think I was going to talk about? Church. How bad church people are. I've been a minister all my life. I know they're all hypocrites. It's blah, 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 blah. What about your minister friends? I wouldn't have said it probably about Buddy, but Buddy was still a pretty young guy back when that happened. But most of my other minister friends, I'd have told you, well, let me tell you about this guy, let me tell you about that guy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then if anybody does anything to feed it, it just convinces you you're right. Like I did at one point early on tell one minister friend privately, individually, that my marriage was having problems, and the next day got a call from a minister 7 states away who said, that guy says that your marriage is in trouble. You think I told him another word? No. Not at all. What do you think happens to my rationalization? They're all hypocrites, they're all no good, et cetera, et cetera. Finally, later, much into it, one group of guys did pull me aside and tried to intervene. They didn't have a clue what they were doing, but they tried to intervene. And I just started telling them about how bad church is, how bad people are, how bad Alice is, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. One of them brilliantly said, if you can't take the heat, get out of the kitchen. And I said, I did. And that was the end of that intervention. All right, look at the next one then. In self-delusion, and I'm quoting from Johnson here, rationalization becomes integral to his or her life. Every inappropriate behavior is rationalized away. And the person is swept further and further from reality and further into delusion. The intellect continues to suppress the emotions and defending its reason until truth is buried beyond reach. Have you ever seen that happen to anybody? It happened to me. And now the business I'm in, I see it happening to people all the time. Next slide, please, sir. Second phase. The first phase is delusion. I'm sorry. The first phase of delusion is rationalization. I'm 65. I don't remember much anymore. Rationalization. Do you think then that because I'm rationalizing that I feel no guilt? What do you think? I'm sorry? You think I do feel guilt? But I can't allow myself to realize that I'm feeling guilt. Does that make any sense to anybody? Look what Johnson says about it. Next slide, please. Though she does not allow herself to feel negatively about her behavior, a, Johnson says, free-floating mass of anxiety, guilt, shame, and remorse exist deep within. Let's put it this way. If my belief in value system is one thing, this is what I believe in value. Now, you must understand, in our world, we define everything. So beliefs in our world are those things you hold to be true. Values are how you expect people to act based on what you believe to be true. Are you with me? So if you believe, for example, that marriage is between a heterosexual male and female, then you value only heterosexual marriage and you devalue homosexual marriage. You follow how this works. So my beliefs determine what I value. Now, when I live in contradiction to my beliefs and values, that's what creates guilt. Now, there are a couple of ways we can avoid feeling guilty, at least consciously feeling guilty. One is a thing called compartmentalized thinking. What that means is my belief and value system is one thing. I'm behaving in contradiction to that belief and value system, but I don't let myself think about both of them at the same time. It's called compartmentalized thinking. Everybody does some compartmentalized thinking. All right. Nobody can do it forever. Eventually those two things come in contact with each other. I believe and value one thing, but what I'm doing is in contradiction to that, and now you actually go into a thing called cognitive dissonance. Dissonance means disharmony. It means you're messed up inside. Anybody besides me ever been there? That you knew what you believed and valued, and knew what you were doing was against that, and it just messed you up, right? Now, people can't live like that. I don't want to be messed up. And so I'm looking for peace. I want the disharmony, the dissonance to go away. There are only two ways to restore peace, just two. I either stop doing the thing in contradiction to my belief and value system, or I alter my belief and value system to allow me to do that action. You understand? It's only been one of those two. Interestingly, whichever of those two I decide, once I make that decision and get some degree of peace, I will refuse to consider any evidence that I made the wrong decision. Now, you've seen people like that. Or you try to tell them, but the Bible says this, and they just blow you away. But don't you know, you used to believe this, and they blow you away. It's because once I have made the decision and found some peace, I will not consider any evidence that indicates I made the wrong decision. Remember that it becomes important. So does that mean the guilt goes away? No, because that belief and value system is still down in there somewhere. And so inside of me, even though on higher levels, upper levels, I may feel some degree of peace, down deep, what I'm feeling is messed up. So what do I do with it? It's going to come out. How do you think it comes out? Next slide, please, sir. Typically, these negative feelings find an outlet through attacking others. I'll attack anyone who tries to convince them that they're doing the wrong thing. So, if some of the church members come to see you and say, this is wrong, you shouldn't do it, you attack the church members. If your spouse says, this is wrong, you shouldn't do it, you attack your spouse. Now, you understand in our world, where we're dealing with marriages in crisis all the time, what kind of things do you think we hear about a person's spouse? Everything in the world. Like, nobody could live with her. I mean, I'm pretty sure she's got a demon. The other night her head went all the way around. You say, you haven't really heard that. I've heard everything but that, trust me. I mean, nobody knows what she's really like. She does this, she does that, she's awful, she's terrible. Or the people at the church, they're just full of hypocrites, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And if their children are grown, they've been brainwashed. Or if they're even younger, saying, stop it. They've gotten to my kids, they've brainwashed them. The only person who understands me, if they're in an affair, the only person who understands me is my lover. And everybody else gets attacked. Boom. And they can walk around with a really, really short fuse. So Jimmy Allen called me one night. Anybody know who Jimmy Allen, the great evangelist? Now, Jimmy's a very direct guy. If you know Jimmy Allen, then you understand this. Jimmy Allen's the only man I ever heard preach on grace and scream at me at the same time. He tracks me down and he calls me and tells me to straighten up, and I told him no, and so he starts screaming at me, which just, in my mind, justified the fact that he's an idiot, they're all idiots, that's fine, and I hung up. I mean, you get it? You can just easily rationalize everything you're doing because they're all idiots. Nobody understands. They're all hypocrites, whatever. Now look at the next one. A common projection is to blame the entire problem on the spouse. If he had only, nobody could live with someone like her. A guy leaving his wife. We're all, mostly adults here and babies. I don't think the babies will be offended by what I'm about to say. He said it's because we've had a terrible sex life since day one. Since day one, oh yes. I wanted to make love more often than she did. He made it sound like that only happened to them. I wanted to make love more often than she did, and she wouldn't be involved, and she doesn't know the great damage she did to me and all of our lives. Then I've been totally unfulfilled, and it's all her fault. And when finally somebody comes along who can give me what I want, if it weren't for my wife being like she was, I'd be happily married now. So it's been her fault for 30 years. Actually, 20 years. Been her fault for 20 years. You heard people talk about these kinds of things? Mm-hmm. And they can begin to justify. Next slide, please, sir. When others respond to those attacks, one of two things typically happens. Those who agree give credence. You might be saying, surely nobody agrees with them. Oh, yeah. Without a doubt. You want to see the worst situation? Take a woman having trouble with her husband who has divorced women friends. And now she starts going out with them. First they're just having meals, then they're going out for drinks. And all these other women are saying, you've got to get rid of that blankety blank, blank, blank. He's terrible, he's awful, he's wicked, he's evil. That's the worst I see. That's almost as bad, but not quite, is the guy hanging out with divorced or single men. Who are saying, you can have fun, you can have thrills, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they actually give credence. I wouldn't live with her either. How in the world could you be with a man like you deserve better than him? Now, if I'm already telling you everything wrong with my spouse and somebody's telling me that I'm right, what do you think that does to my delusion? It makes my delusion stronger. You say, okay, then we disagree. Well, those who disagree harden her into a position. If you say, she does not have a demon, you did not see her head go all the way around. You weren't there. It really, well, maybe not all the way, but it went most of the way around. I'll guarantee you. And she's so mean. I sleep in the bathtub at night because I think she's going to kill me with a butcher knife. So the more you tell the person that he or she is wrong, the harder they get in their position. Now you might be thinking, well, wait a minute. You said don't agree with them and don't disagree with them. What does that leave? Here's what I do. She's got a demon. I go, that's bad. Her head went all the way around the other night. That's bad, but we can fix it. You can cast out demons? Yep. Done it before, do it again. And then they don't know what else to say. Well, Kayla, what can't you do? I just don't argue with them. Well, that's pretty bad. We'll fix that later. I just don't argue with them at all. I'm not going to give any credence either way. Next slide, if you will. Just as rationalization must be an unconscious act to benefit the self-deluded, so must projection. That's where they're projecting their anger and their hurt and their bitterness on other people. She actually believes she's standing up for herself, or even in extreme cases, standing for the truth of God. When it really gets to me is when they start quoting Scripture. And they're quoting Scripture not to know what God wants, but quoting Scripture to justify that what they're doing is okay. You ever heard that? So the next slide says, the defense of self becomes part of the delusion. She can focus on another person or a group of people instead of having to deal with self, giving even more power to the delusion within. The fight with them keeps her from having to fight with herself. Now, you've seen this, right? So I maybe in my situation would attack Alice's family. Oh, they're all terrible, or her mother, or whatever. Or the people at church, or all these things we've talked about, and none of my friends are really my friends. People only like me because they get things from me, and now that they can't get things from me, they're not my friends anymore. And whatever delusion you go into, I'll guarantee you, you can find proof that you're right. There'll be just enough going on out there that you can look at and say, I knew it. I'm right. Okay, next one. Third phase, repression. Now, what was the first phase? Rationalization. Excellent. What was the second one? Projection. Very good. And the third one now is repression. Next slide, please, sir. As the destructive behavior escalates, the person crosses more boundaries. I'm going to explain that just for a second. John, did you bring that clipboard? Would you start passing? This is John Hayslip. John works with us at Marriage Helper. He takes care of our spiritual section of what we do over there. This guy's got to come around. If you want me to send you an email telling you how to get to this stuff, or even more stuff that we have, just put your name and email address on there, and you will get an email from me, so don't put me in your spam thing, okay? Or if you just want to go to marriagehelper.com, you can do that too, but we'll pass that around, and if you don't get a chance passing around, they'll be up here, just your name and your email. We never sell our email address to anybody else. We just give it away. No. Nobody ever gets our email address. We'll protect it. Now, Can I be pretty adult right here for a minute? I mean, it's going to be a little offensive to some. Can I just take a minute and do it? All right, so a person has an affair. Have they crossed any boundaries? So do you think they're going to cross more? See, it's not unusual for a person who is in an extramarital affair to do things sexually they have never done with their spouse. Because in their own mind, that was not within my boundaries. So, and I'm trying not to illustrate here, because that's what made Lester Holt sweat. You've never lived till you're on the Today Show and actually say the word masturbation. So, here we are. It's live, they can't edit it. So, here we are. It wasn't me, it was the other guy. So they wind up doing things that they have never done with their spouse, but they do these things sexually. You say, why? Because once you cross one boundary, all boundaries begin to fall. And they can wind up doing things that you would have never, ever expected them to do. Not just sexual things, but things with alcohol. Not just things with alcohol, but things with drugs. Not just things with drugs, but things with more people. Now, you say, then if a person has an affair, they've done everything. No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying once you cross one boundary, other boundaries are now ready to fall, and many of them do. Don't be shocked when you find out that a person's crossed a lot of boundaries, okay? By the way, every one of those that they cross creates more tension inside of them, which makes them do more attacking of other people. So as the destructive behavior escalates, the person crosses more boundaries. They often reach a stage where they can no longer rationalize certain acts. It can actually get so far that now they can't even rationalize it anymore. So what do? Look at the next thing. Every action he can no longer justify now disappears from memory. The choice not to remember is not made with the conscious mind. It's made with the subconscious. He's keeping himself from facing his own contradictions. They literally do not remember some of the things that they do. And I don't mean from a year ago. I mean from yesterday. Things just disappear. Because it is so far out there, past my boundary, that now that I've done it, I can't rationalize it, therefore I can't justify it. And so how do I live with it? I just push it down like it never happened. So look at the next slide about this. Altered memory. That's the fourth. Altered memory. Now look at this. Nearly every person who reaches marital crisis rewrites marital history. Events from the past are interpreted differently. For example, when dealing with a marriage, it's not unusual to hear, I never loved her, I'm not sure why I married her, but I know that I never did love her. I actually said those words. Alice and I had not yet divorced. We were in deep, deep marriage trouble. She convinced me, we were living in Montgomery, Alabama, she convinced me to go over to Auburn to see a PhD by the name of Glenn. I didn't go to save the marriage. I went because I felt like that since we've been married 15 years and had two children together, that I owed her. So I went. In one of the visits, Glenn said, now, when you first fell in love with Alice, and I went, no, I never fell in love with Alice, never. You've never loved Alice? Oh, I love her. I love her like a sister. She's a good person, but I have never been in love with Alice. That's how we ended that session. When we came back to start the next session, apparently he and Alice had communicated in between. We start the next session. He said, let's start where we left off last time. Now, you say that you have never, ever been in love with Alice. I said, that's correct. So he turned to Alice and said, may I have them? She pulled a stack of letters out of her purse, held together with a big rubber band. She pulled out one at random, handed it to him. He opened it, read it, and then handed it to me and pointed to a paragraph and said, now read that paragraph out loud. I did. He said, now the fellow who wrote that, was he in love with Alice? I said, apparently. He said, who signed that? I said, it looks a lot like my signature. He said, then you were in love with Alice. And I said, no, those are the ramblings of a boy. He didn't know what he was feeling. I have never been in love with Alice. Now, do you understand why I could not believe my own handwriting? Because then the guilt comes back to the surface. If the guilt comes back to the surface, I'm messed up again. I don't want to be messed up because I know what I want to do. I want to divorce her. I want to go do this. It's all set up. I'm headed that way. Nothing's going to stop me. Nothing. And so I wouldn't even believe my own handwriting. And so it's not unusual for us to hear, oh, I love her, but I've never been in love with her. You say, do you argue with them? Oh, remember, we don't argue with them. We don't go, well, I'm sorry you never were. We don't go, well, you know that you are. I just go, okay, I hear you. I don't want to deal with this. We want to get past the delusion. And so when people have altered memory, by the way, some of you have had, if you've had problems with your children, they've had altered memories about some of the things they went through with you as well. Is that right? Okay, look at the next thing here. Altered memories give credence to current rationalizations. If one convinces himself that his spouse has always been a bad mate, that life has been terrible for years, or that his spouse is impossible to live with, then he can rationalize that leaving the spouse is not wrong, it's survival. Now, let me give you a little caveat to this. It's not always rewritten history. Sometimes they tell you really stinking stuff that the spouse did. The 28-year-old young lady in love with a 36-year-old man. Remember I talked about her at the beginning? She said, my husband, who was a very dominant personality, she said, my husband has brought other women into our home for us to be with. She said, so see, he's evil. Now, he confirmed the fact that he had done that. So now we're looking at this going, he really has done some really bad stuff. Now, you might at that point, particularly if you're not in this business a lot, might at that point be going, well, that's a sin. You might count that as adultery, a violation of the marriage contract. You might count it as fornication, a sexual sin. And you might say, well, you should just go ahead and divorce him then. Can you see how you might go ahead and do that? But you got to look at the whole picture. What is she doing? She's in love with this other guy who's married and have children. So if I say, wow, you should divorce him because of that, where is she headed? Right into the arms of the lover. Is that good? So what do I say? What he did was wrong. It was bad. As a matter of fact, let's call him in here so we can both tell him how bad it was. And we pulled him into the room, and I looked at him and said, you're an idiot. I cleaned that up just for you. I said, if you're ever going to have this woman back, you can't act like that anymore. So along this line, you understand that they will make that person, they'll paint a bad picture, but some of what they say, the person's actually done. If the goal is to rescue the individual, it's still not to be moved off task, because that's exactly what they're doing. They're moving you off task. That's what they do in the delusion. Next slide. Very quickly, we're going to wrap up. My time's up. They also alter memories of things that happened recently. If she cannot forget an act, she alters the interpretation of what happened so that it justifies the act. She may have been with a guy last night, but all she remembers is kissing, and that actually happens. The next thing, very quickly, why is delusion important to understand? Here we go. Number one, you will stop expecting a self-deluded person to come to his senses. Stop expecting deluded people to come to their senses. They are not coming to their senses. They're not in their senses. So stop expecting them to fix it. The next thing, you'll throw out that old, terribly wrong concept that there's nothing anyone can do until they want help. They don't want help because they've convinced themselves they're not doing anything wrong. So if you wait until they say they want help, you're never going to save them. The next thing, people addicted to damaging behaviors do not want help because they cannot allow themselves to admit what they're doing is wrong. Their delusions make them believe everything they do is okay and everything that they say is true. Next slide. That means they cannot help themselves. They will not overcome their damaging actions without help from someone who cares and who is not deluded about their behavior. So tomorrow, if you choose to come back, I'll tell you how to do it. But you can't do it without understanding this, because they'll take you all over the map. They'll run you up and down roller coasters and into rabbit holes and every place else. You have to know what they're doing, so when they take off on their delusions, you just bring them right back to where they need to be, and Lord willing, he'll show you that tomorrow. If you want to sign that thing for the email, we'll be glad to do that. Otherwise, Marriage Helper, have a great day. How are you doing, my friend?